stuff. Other people have the theory that the real world is spiritual or mental. But I want you to point out that both those theories of the world are concepts. They're constructions of words. And the real world is not an idea. It is not words. Reality is...
Chuck Foster. Join me at 2 p.m. Sundays for Reggae Central, playing ska, rock steady, roots, dub, and dancehall. New releases, old favorites, and delightful obscurities right here on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Pankaj Mishra, in his latest book, The War After Gaza, argues that the post-war global order was shaped in response to the Nazi Holocaust. In the West, the Shoah was the benchmark for atrocity, the paradigmatic genocide. Its memory serves to justify Israel's settler colonial apartheid state, as well as sanctify Jewish victimhood. But there were, he notes, other Holocausts, the German slaughter of the Herero, the Armenian genocide, the Bengal famine of 1943, then-British Prime Minister Winston Churchill airily dismissed the deaths of 3 million Hindus in the famine by calling them, quote, a beastly people with a beastly religion, along with the dropping of nuclear bombs on the civilian targets of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Genocide and mass extermination are not the exclusive domain of fascist Germany. The millions of victims of racist imperial projects in countries such as Mexico, China, India, the Congo, Kenya, and Vietnam are deaf to the fatuous claims by Jews that their victimhood is unique. So are Black, Brown, and Native Americans. They also suffered Holocausts. But these Holocausts remain minimized or unacknowledged by their Western perpetrators. Adolf Hitler, as Ami Cesari writes in Discourse on Colonialism, appeared exceptionally cruel only because he presided over the humiliation of the white man. But the Nazis, he writes, had simply applied colonialist procedures, which until then had been reserved exclusively for the Arabs of Algeria, the coolies of India, and the blacks of Africa. Outside of the West, Mishra argues, there is a very different paradigm. The dominant story for much of the globe is that of decolonialization and the crimes of the colonizers. This divergence of experience and viewpoint explain, Mishra writes, why there has been such desperate reactions to the genocide in Gaza, why to those in the global south there was an instant understanding of the plight of the Palestinians, why they see the clear color lines between the Israeli occupiers and the Palestinians, why they grasp how in the West the world is starkly divided into worthy and unworthy victims. Joining me to discuss The World After Gaza is Pankaj Mishra, author of Age of Anger, A History of the Present, and other works of fiction and nonfiction. He writes regularly for The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, The Guardian, and The London Review of Books, among other publications. You open the book by talking very early on about what watching this live-streamed genocide has done. You call it a psychic ordeal, which it is, of course, especially for those of us, such as myself, who worked in Gaza, an involuntary witness to an act of political evil. But it sends, as you write, a message, a clear, unequivocal message to the rest of the world. What is it?
I think it's a message that we are perhaps moving into an era where international law, basic morality, ordinary decency are not going to be found much, especially not in the conduct of our politicians and journalists. And that is, I think, you know, something much, much more disturbing than what many people knew back in the 1930s, because back then there were a lot of countries actively pushing back, resisting the onslaught of fascism. And precisely those very same countries today are, you could say, at the forefront of authoritarianism, something worse than authoritarianism, actually.
Why is it worse?
Well, I think, you know, this is, in the past we've had authoritarianism, such as that we've seen in China and elsewhere, that has not, you know, made claims on other people's territory, especially territories thousands of miles away. Just in the last couple of weeks, we have seen some extraordinary series of statements and claims by the new U.S. president, which can only portend, you know, an era of more bloodshed, more chaos. I mean, there's no getting around this fact that is staring us in the face right now.
I want to talk about the way, in particularly, the Western world has responded. Not just the leadership, which of course has made any kind of dissent to the genocide on college campuses and other places a criminal act, and hounded professors and students who have stood up, but also the press. You note about the New York Times editors instructing their staff in an internal memo to avoid the terms refugee camps, occupied territory, and ethnic cleansing. How much does this portend the kind of the moral bankruptcy within Western culture?
I would say, look, I don't know about Western culture. I can speak very specifically about, you know, certain very prestigious, at least formally prestigious, legacy periodicals who have manifested a degree of not only moral, but a sort of intellectual bankruptcy in confronting Israel's actions in Gaza and elsewhere, of course, in Syria and Lebanon. The omissions, the suppressions, the evasions, the sheer accumulation of mendacity, of falsehoods, I think, you know, I just think I can't think of a more terrible indictment of the mainstream press, such as we have seen over the last few months. And I really sort of fear that these periodicals are not going to be able to recover from this. This is a lasting damage to their credibility, to their legitimacy. And I say this as a concerned writer, as a contributor to some of these periodicals. How do you recover from something like this? There is no easy way back to some kind of, you know, intellectual and moral integrity. They also seem completely helpless at this point, you know, clueless, I think is the word. Before Trump, before this onslaught of the far right, they actually have really no responses to this. Every time Trump says something, he says, let's ethnically cleanse Gaza. They come up with an article saying, oh, but there is a problem in this plan that is, you know, the presence of Hamas in Gaza. So I think, you know, we are looking at a steady normalization of the most violent and extreme kind of rhetoric. This is what the mainstream press has to offer at this moment.
You spend a lot of time in your book talking about the Holocaust and quote a lot of, you know, great writers about the Holocaust like Primo Levi. You write that remembering past atrocities is no guarantee against repeating them in the present, which of course raises the whole issue of the plethora of Holocaust studies which exist on every university in this country, well-funded. Germany itself, of course, holds up the Holocaust as a kind of penance within German society. And yet we watch it once again. What's failed? What didn't work?
Well, I think if you're going to teach the Holocaust as a very, specific lesson, whose main message is the protection of the state of Israel, no matter what the state of Israel does. Then, of course, you'll end up in this situation where Germany, which actually it sort of makes the strongest claim, as a sort of regular commemorator of Nazi crimes against Jews, and combined with very solid support for the state of Israel. But of course, it's completely unthinking, completely uncritical. So we've reached a point where, where German arms have fueled Israel's attack on Gaza, Israel's destruction of Gaza. And yet there is no recognition that, you've got to stop at some point. You do have a great responsibility to the state of Israel, but that does not mean giving them a license to commit endless massacres. I think you could say the same about Holocaust education in many other places, that its very particular lesson seems to be do whatever you can to protect the state of Israel, no matter how wildly and violently the state of Israel behaves.
Well, there was a quid pro quo at the end of World War II. Germany immediately sended, almost immediately after the founding of the state of Israel in 1948, began to supply it with weapons and, of course, billions of dollars in reparations. And the quid pro quo was that they turned the other way and didn't look at the dispossession of Palestinians of their land. And Israel gave Germany a kind of legitimacy, I think you argue.
I do argue that. And I think, the evidence now is clear. People have started to look into this more closely. Couple of books out that I refer to. And I think the utterly cynical nature of these transactions is now much, much plainer than it was. I think we realize that, large numbers of people have been deceived into thinking that this was some kind of a moral debt that the Germans owed, and that's what they were discharging all this time. It's now clear that actually there were some really insidious elements to this relationship, and especially, I think, the exchange of heavy weaponry, exchange of arms, and often sort of naked bribery and sort of blackmail. It's quite really shocking, some of the details of this relationship.
Well, even during the Eichmann trial, they go so far as to protect a major Nazi figure within the hierarchy of the German government, not to name him.
Absolutely. I mean, there are many, many such sordid sort of details locked away, actually, in archives, which are still inaccessible to researchers and to writers. I'm sure more of this stuff is going to come out at some point.
Let's talk about the Holocaust that beset the global South. I mentioned the famine, Kenya, because I think that is one of the crucial points of your book, that those historical experiences and that lasting trauma, which is minimized, whitewashed. I just read Imperial Reckoning, the book on the British crushing of the Mau Mau. And what was, it's a great book, but what was so disturbing about it was the silence that not just the Moi, the Kenyans, the West, the Brits managed to envelop the wholesale slaughter of Kikuyu and others within Kenya. But that's just typical of what we have done to erase the experience of many, many peoples. Can you talk about that, all those late Victorian Holocausts that we've kind of written out of history?
Well, Chris, I think there is an accusation, which is often grounded, leveled against many people in Asian countries and African countries, that they are indulging in Holocaust denial. And often there are people in Asia and Africa who are either really ignorant about this, monstrous act of violence, which is the Holocaust. And often there are people who are very, you know, extremely underinformed if they do anything, if they do know something about it. And I think what is much less remarked upon is the extraordinary level of a version of Holocaust denial in Western countries. You know, the fact that there's this long past of imperialism, of slavery, of, you know, enormous violence inflicted on many different parts of the world, many different populations across the world. If you today try to bring this up or try to talk about it, you'd be denounced as, you know, a member of some woke conspiracy and dismissed or stigmatized or denounced. But this is something that's been going on for an extremely long time. And I think among the other consequences, this has had an effect of seriously crippling any attempt at understanding the world as it exists today. You know, the fact that large parts of the world have a cultural memory, a historical memory of the atrocities that were inflicted on those parts of the world by Western powers. And that has actually gone into the making of their collective identity. And that is how they see themselves in the world. That's how they position themselves in the world. And of course, that narrative that they believe in is now much more antagonistic, much more in a way assertive, especially when it comes into contact with these Western self-flattering narratives about, you know, how the West beat down two major totalitarian regimes, how it, you know, liberated the sort of Jews of Auschwitz, you know, just very recently.
Which I just want to interrupt, which you, as you point out in the book, isn't true historically.
Of course,
the Soviets liberated almost all the death camps.
Of course, you know, there are ways in which you can, you know, spin D-Day as far more important than all the contributions of the Red Army. The way in which history is taught in large parts of Western Europe and the United States, you know, the fact that you still had as late as the early 2000s, the BBC broadcasting a documentary about the British Empire that made the British seem, you know, globally benevolent force. It's not at all surprising that there would be today amplifying propaganda about what is happening in Gaza today. You know, these have been propagandist outfits for some time, sort of indoctrinating, brainwashing large populations. And so I think, you know, this is a really serious problem that has to be addressed. You know, some of these antagonistic narratives have to be reconciled. It's really, you know, leading to just more conflict and more animosity, because a lot of this long history of violence is simply not acknowledged. Nobody's really seriously asking for reparations, you know, or I mean, there are a very small number of people who are doing that. But a simple acknowledgement that there is this very long history of suffering that we've all participated in, both as victims and perpetrators.
I want to talk about Jewish identity. You quote Evron, or Boaz Evron, that Israel, for many Jews in the West, had become necessary because the loss of any other focal point to their Jewish identity, indeed so great was their existential lack, that they did not wish Israel to become free of its mounting dependence on Jewish American support. I thought that was a really important point. Can you explain?
You know, Chris, I think, you know, this is something that could be applied to a lot of diasporic populations, especially in the United States. People who moved there from elsewhere, with sort of ancestral memories, some idea of their ancestral heritage. And I think at some point, while living in the United States, living in what is essentially a materialistic society with not much of a tradition, with not much of a heritage, unlike, you know, most other parts of the world, and they seek to capture some kind of meaning, some kind of identity for themselves by affiliating themselves to, you know, the sort of ancestral heritage that they have. And I think in many cases, you know, most famously, I can see this in the case of Hindu nationalism, for instance. There are any number of people, secular, highly educated, people with no faith in God, no sort of religious faith whatsoever, and yet can become extremely vulnerable to the idea of Hindu nationalism. And so likewise, I think, you know, there has been a large population of Jewish Americans who, despite their secular education, have felt almost a kind of existential imperative to attach themselves to the state of Israel. These are people who are not necessarily, you know, descendants of the survivors of the Holocaust, but yet there is a very strong connection. And I think it has to do with the peculiar situation of a society that doesn't really offer you too many ways in which to define yourself meaningfully as a member of a larger spiritual and emotional community.
Well, you cite that rootlessness in your book, Age of Anger, as being a kind of key factor in the political distortions, whether it's in India or here or anywhere else.
I think that's right, Chris. I mean, I think, you know, it's really important to stress that the Israeli case is not an exception. It's actually, you know, an amplification in a very distorted form of a lot of pathologies that we also see in the case of other populations, whether it's, you know, the Sikh secessionists or Sikh, the sympathy for Sikh nationalism. It's just that the Israeli case is far more politically consequential, and it distorts, I think, the foreign policy of the United States, distorts the domestic policy of the United States to a much greater extent than, say, the Irish support for Irish nationalism or the Hindu support for Hindu nationalism.
It's a small point in the book, but I think an important one. But you write about the endemic racism within the philosophical traditions of the West. Hegel had sneered at Jews as much as he did at Asians and Africans while elaborating his philosophy of universal development. But this was common. Locke, everyone, was really grounded in a kind of white supremacy. And we kind of wash that stuff out when we read them in university. But I think it's an important point.
It's an important point. I mean, I think, you know, the fact that there is this construction, which is the sort of Western tradition, that has come in hugely useful for ideological projects of the kind we saw during the Cold War, you know, representing, creating the unity of the so-called free world, in which, you know, these disparate philosophical figures can be enlisted and sort of seen as speaking of, you know, certain kind of freedom. Of course, we know that freedom was really only available to a tiny minority back in the 19th century or back in the 18th century. And yet, you know, these philosophers, whether it's Locke or even John Stuart Mill, they're all sort of enlisted into this grand parade of Western civilization. And these are all, you know, constructions. These are all ways of inventing tradition. And that's something we should be more aware of rather than taking all this at face value. You know, just as the Indians have their own kind of invented traditions, just as the Russians have their own and the Chinese have their own, the West has its own invented traditions where, you know, a lot of aspects, especially the ones you describe, have been actively suppressed.
It's a footnote, but a fascinating one. And it gets into your discussion of the Holocaust itself. I think it's Primo Levi, you quote about how the real tragedy of the Holocaust, aside from the loss of life, was that it unleashed evil. But at one point, this is you're quoting Gita Sereny's book about one of the survivors, that when the transports came in, as of tomorrow, the transports will be rolling again. And do you know what we felt? We said to ourselves, hurrah, at last we can fill our bellies again. I have a friend who was in Auschwitz at the age of 14, and I asked her that question, how she felt when she saw the transports come in, and she said we were happy because we knew we could eat. And I want to talk, Primo Levi, I mean, many of the writers on the Holocaust, or several that you quote, committed suicide, Levi among them, but I think they grappled with the fundamental truths of the Holocaust about the human condition, which you write about in your book. Can you kind of explain what their position was and what those truths were?
Thanks, Chris. I think, you know, Primo Levi was one of those people who was not content with a straightforward tale of a narrative of victimhood. He could have easily laid claim to that particular narrative. He was in Auschwitz. He was there for several months. He managed to survive it just barely. Made his escape, went back to Italy, and he could have, spent the rest of his life just in the way someone like Elie Wiesel did.
What do you call him, the Jesus of the Holocaust or something?
Jesus of the Holocaust. That's actually Alfred Kazin calling him that.
Right, right.
He could have also become the Italian Jesus of the Holocaust and just kept talking endlessly about that experience and how that experience commits him to the defense, eternal defense of the state of Israel. He did not do that. And it's interesting to ask why. Because as he grew older, and I think it's interesting towards the end of his life, the books he's writing, the essays he's writing, are concerned with the question of complicity. They're concerned with the question of collaboration. They're concerned with asking broader questions about our own complicity in systems of violence and dispossession. And really also questioning, in many ways, the whole sort of narrative that has become popular in the West of survivors. He realizes, especially in his encounters with Elie Wiesel, that this narrative has become incredibly influential, and it's leading to bad political outcomes. And we think we need much more complex thinking on this, much more complex reflection on this. And that's where he talks in his last published book, The Drowned and the Saved, about, I think there's a chapter in there called The Gray Zone. And he talks about the figure of the collaborator and how, in many ways, I mean, this is a very surprising...
Well, he's talking about the head of the Lodz ghetto in particular,
right.
Ronkowski.
Yeah, exactly. And, he concludes that that collaborator actually exists in all of us, and that we are also too concerned with really with our sort of, survival, too concerned to protect ourselves, and in, many cases, too concerned with social advancement, some kind of a social status. So we don't actually, take the risks that we are supposed to take. We become fearful. We sort of retreat into a kind of herd morality. We go along with what other people are doing. And this is not just Primo Levi. This is also the conclusions reached by other people who have examined in some detail the behavior of Nazis or German soldiers during the Second World War, how much they were motivated, not so much by ideology, not so much by anti-Semitism, but by very simple things like career advancement, by the possibility of material improvements in their lives. And I think it's really important to keep that in focus when we talk about these things. If you look at this new documentary, The BB Files, I'm sure you've seen it.
I haven't yet. Oh.
It becomes very clear, I strongly recommend it, becomes very clear that, Netanyahu is only sort of secondarily motivated by his ideological commitments. I think what has taken precedence in his case is the accumulation of personal power and personal wealth. And that is what has been driving him all this time. That is what has basically shaped many of his policies, whether his, decision to declare unlimited war on his neighbors, whether it's his policy of criminal indifference to the fate of the hostages in Gaza. All he wants really to hold on to his power and to stay out of prison, most importantly. And he also wants that supply, that flow of expensive pink champagne and cigars coming in from his rich friends in America. So he, he's a really sort of interesting case, not so much of ideological fanaticism. I mean, he and Trump are more alike in many ways than we realize. And they're not bound together by any shared belief in Zionism. They're bound together purely by self-interest.
Great. Thank you, Pankaj.
Thanks, Chris.
I want to thank Diego, Sophia, Thomas, and Max, who produced the show. You can find me at chrishedges.substack.com.